Blog Talk Radio.
Experience with co-host Dolly Miller Brennan.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.
And now your host, the notorious MJH.
Groundhog Day. Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. How did that groundhog dig his way up out of 2.5 feet of snow up there in Pennsylvania to even see his shadow or not? But apparently he saw his shadow and crawled back into his hole, which means we're going to have a short winter and springtime is right around the corner, supposedly. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not, but sometimes he is right. Well, today we have, this is our cast for Sunday show, and tonight we have Andrew Castaneda with us, and he's going to talk about immigration reform, and this sounds very interesting to me because I'm trying to figure out how you're supposed to reform an immigrant. But anyway, let me now introduce our co-host, the Dolly Miller Brennan, who will in turn introduce the Andrew Castaneda, and we'll get the show rolling. Dolly Miller Brennan, are you there?
Well, Michael, thank you, and let me tell you, if this groundhog was in Wisconsin, there ain't no way, baby, he's going to be able to dig himself out of this hole and see anything. Let alone his shadow, he's not even going to see the light of day.
I feel bad, because it was like 67 degrees here yesterday. I didn't like it. I was like, what, springtime already? No, but yeah, we had really nice weather. And actually, those storms didn't need some warm weather to push them and keep them going. And we supplied the warm weather to all you guys up there in the north and northwest. So
my friends back in El Paso were telling me it was 2 degrees below zero. Of course, it's not going to last as long there, but we don't get that kind of weather out there. And I'm sure, by the way, please, everybody knows Andrew Castaneda, our cast for Senate, and I'm sure that he's getting some awful cold weather too, because up there by Austin, it's pretty cold, especially in Oklahoma.
Yeah, it was pretty chilly. I think somebody on the radio said the other day that, you know, we got the Green Bay Packers coming down here for the Super Bowl, and then it's colder here than it is in Green Bay.
Well, I know my friends were saying last week, you got to come home,
Yeah, also, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but yeah, they're playing the Super Bowl at Texas Stadium this year. That's where they're at.
Yeah, it's in Dallas, yeah. They had videos out about a Texans trying to pronounce Wisconsin names. Hey, when I came up here, I couldn't pronounce anything. I thought, what the hell is this? But they're all Indian names. So I appreciated that. A friend of mine sent me that about Texans not being able to pronounce Wisconsin names. But, hey, Wisconsinites can't always pronounce Texas names either. So it turned out to be okay. Like I said last week, my friend said, pardon me?
I said, so I guess you're going for the Packers?
You know, I'm not a big football fan. I love my basketball, but I'm not a big football fan. But the Packers have been good to me. I've worked with the corporate office for many years in producing events, and they've been extremely generous to me in sending me players for Packer parties. When I do a charity event, they would send me five players. They would send me five players, and I got to, Bob, what was his name, the manager. They sent me the manager and five players, and they signed autographs. They were all free, and for usually every event, they'll give me an autographed football, and I sponsored, I helped with a fundraising event in New Mexico, and they even sent a package of materials out to New Mexico to help that charity. So the corporate Packers are a really, really good organization, and they've been very good to me, and I can't say enough good things about them. And when I had the players and Bob come in, the manager, and they were wonderful to everybody. Those guys sat there and signed autograph after autograph after autograph and let them take their pictures with it. And this is a big deal because they charge for this. So the Packers, again, have been very good to me. And the Brewers have been very good to me, too, in regard to, and the Bucks. All the teams appear have been good to me in regard to public relations. But nevertheless,
I know where the Brewers get their name, but what is a Packer? Because, I mean, you know,
like, I know the Green Bay Packer, because it was a meatpacking place was where they're from. They are the only community-owned team. The community owns the Packers. And the Brewers, of course, went from the Braves to the Brewers because of all the Milwaukee breweries. Somebody asked me what
buzz related. Yeah, I get that. I get that one. That's because of the steel mills. But I didn't know, because they asked it on TV yesterday, but they never told you.
The Packers came from the meatpacking plants up there. And,
Wisconsin is known for the cheese. So I was thinking, well, what do they pack, cheese? Or, you know, okay, now I get it.
Yeah,
so who are you going for in the Super Bowl there, Cass?
Who am I going for?
Yeah, who are you going for in the game?
Well, you know, I can't really say.
Well, you know, my girlfriend.
You know, even though neither team's from Texas, but still.
My girlfriend always has a Packer party when the Packers play, and she's from Mexico originally. Yeah, when the Packers play, she's originally from Mexico. She's a legal immigrant. She's originally from Mexico. She's been here for years. Her husband's a naval captain, retired, and very astute politician. And but the only thing about Maria's Packer parties, I try to get there late, because every time the Packers have a touchdown, you have to drink a shot of tequila. Well, I'm actually allergic to alcohol. I can drink very little of it. So I get a little tiny bit in the glass, and I just, the tiniest I can, I just chug it, and I try to get there so I don't have to have too many, because you have to do it. It's a sin if you don't. That's my Packer party story.
All right. Well, let's go to Cass and find out how to reform immigrants.
Oh, absolutely. Cass, I've been looking at this today, and the Georgia farmers were saying that, you know, they can't have this. They need the illegal immigrants to work the corn and tomato crops, and without them, they can't afford to pay any other wages. And I thought, really? What they want is slave labor. And they said, and if they have to check if they're legal, they can't afford to do that. Now, these are farmers that are not poor farmers, and they're making large profits. So what is your position here? Do you think that they are really – I think they're using slave labor. I lived in Georgia when I was a teenager, and believe me, they're not treated well.
Well, when you look at the whole illegal immigration issue, and I'm fixing to post my position on the website here right after the show so that people can have a better view of exactly where I stand on all this. And I look at it from three perspectives. You have the one big issue that's caught a lot of attention, and that has to do with the border security. We focus a lot on basically the southwest border between basic Texas and Arizona and probably California. So border security is that number one major hot issue that everybody's focused on. And then we're also looking at from the economic perspective of, you know, social service programs, whether it's Medicaid or food stamps or other programs that they feel that the individuals are withdrawing from or using that are costing our economy and so forth, as well as the ones that you just talked about, the job. So when I'm looking at illegal immigration, I'm looking at like a three-headed kind of approach. One is has to do, we have to focus on what I call our border enforcement or our national sovereignty. We also have to focus on the most important other aspect of that, which really drives all of illegal immigration, and that is our legislative processes, our legislative laws that are in place as far as, you know, who can enforce those laws and how do we want to enforce those laws and how can we, you know, increase or decrease immigration here in the United States. And the third component of that is going to focus specifically on citizenship, which basically means that, you know, I was once at a training where an individual said, Congress does not pass laws, society does. And what he was saying was that, you know, Congress can pass any law it wants, but unless society chooses to accept and live by that law, then it's not going to happen. You know, for instance, when Congress decided to abolish, you know, the consumption of alcohol in the United States, what ended up happening in the society said, you know, we're not crazy about this idea. And for whatever reason, they went in and amended the Constitution to change it back. And that was a good example of how society really enforces laws. So whatever laws are passed by Congress, it's society's choice to decide whether they want to live by those or not or enforce them. Because when you think about it, citizens of the United States, just like you were talking about in Georgia or in every other part of the United States, they know some of these individuals who are here illegally, but they kind of turn the other way from, you know, whether they want to enforce that law or not, or they want to take a different approach to it. So we really got to take this back to the process owners in a nutshell, and that's going to be the citizens. So when we look at, for instance, that first part, let's talk about border security, and then we can kick this around for a little bit. What I'm proposing or I recommend in reference to illegal immigration is border enforcement. And I have pretty much 5 points that I'm focused on, and one of those is first of all, let's put our Coast Guard, the United States Coast Guard, on the waterways to enforce American laws on American territory, which basically means to protect American citizens. Kind of like the situation you had in at the lake down there in South Texas where an individual was supposedly killed and so forth. You know, we have to have some sense of national sovereignty there to protect our American citizens. And that's a pretty big lake, so it's hard to tell which side's the American side and which side's, you know, the Mexican side. The other thing is we have to empower our state governors on all borders. Now, like I said, we'll focus on the southwest border, but we got to really think up there in Wisconsin and all the other places, New York, you know, that have a northern border.
Wisconsin has a large, seasonal influx of immigrants to work fields up here, and they're not treated well, and they're not paid well.
And that's actually where it goes into the legislation perspective that I'll be talking here in just a bit about how we kind of focus on that. But when we're talking about empowering state governors, we're talking about for the north border and the south border to be able to utilize the National Guard or whatever, the state militia, to kind of enforce or protect the citizens of that country, the citizens of those states. You know, especially down here in the state of Texas where, you know, we have violence that's probably flowing over from the border side to the American side. And if it's taking American lives, then, you know, that's just unacceptable.
Well, you know, when you speak about the borders, and I love what your concept is regarding border security. It was last Friday, Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa sent a letter to the ATF stating that his office had received numerous allegations that the ATF, you know, actually sanctioned the sale of hundreds of assault weapons to suspected straw purchasers who then illegally transported these weapons through the southwest border area and into Mexico. So, like you say, if we have real border security.
Well, yeah, and it's on both sides of the border when you're talking about something like that. But there's also something you got to take into consideration about, you know, statistics and how they're presented. For instance, let's just take the gun sales. You know, let's just say we have 100,000 guns. Out of 100,000 guns, 5,000 of those that are confiscated, 5,000 of those have serial numbers, and only 5,000 of those, let's say 90% of them, are coming from the United States. Well, the sensational media is going to say 90% of the sales or 90% of the guns confiscated on the border with the drug cartel are American-made weapons. Well, that's only 90% of the 5,000 that were traceable. You're still talking about another 95,000 that are probably untraceable, and we're not sure exactly where that's coming from. So, you know, I'm always kind of hesitant to take any statistic right off the top and say, okay, that's what it is, because I can be the best at skewing any kind of statistic to make it to be my way, but that's not to say that the drug cartels are not getting American weapons. I mean, you know, one of the more refined manufacturers in the Second Amendment of producing weapons, and it should be.
One of the whistleblowers that contacted Grassley's office, you know, about Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and one of the whistleblowers contacted his office, and this employee, the ATF employee, was being charged with misconduct by the ATF for talking to Senate staffers. So it's like they're really trying to shut them up and not even allowing them to speak to any type of governmental control.
Well, in reality, and I think without having to go, you know, especially, you know, I don't want to kind of throw it out there, but experience in what what's real and what's behind the curtain, supposedly, like the Wizard of Oz. There's more to it than just that. And whether it's the ATF or the CIA or NSA or any other agency, there's more to it than just, you know, the sale of weapons and the production of or manufacturing of drugs or illegal substances, you know, from a profit perspective. So,
well,
you know,
my boss used to say, he says, if you think we're involved and it's so ludicrous, you can't possibly believe it. He said, imagine that it's true and magnify it 10,000 times and you will not have begun to scratch the surface of the true involvement. So I think what you're saying is exactly right on target.
Exactly.
And I hope everybody's listening and understands you, how on target you are.
Because that's why you'll see some of the instances you talked about, and if the ATF is trying to try this individual to not talk to, you know, legislative staff. And we are the legislators. We're the ones that need to know what's exactly going on, because it's the people that look to us to protect them. It's the people that look to us to kind of represent them and ensure that we have, you know, good programs in place and good policies in place and legislation in place to support the Constitution. If somebody can't freely tell me, you know, something's going on, then we got issues. The other thing I was talking about.
One other area you touched on, you said exactly what it cost in terms of taxpayers. In regard to, as you said, you know, if they're given services, I think they're saying, let me pull this up. The Mexican ambassador says illegal aliens burdening taxpayers is urban myth, that they're not given any benefits. But they're saying the total cost for illegal immigrants to county taxpayers exceeds $1.6 billion. That was in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to say that there's definitely a taxpayer that's paying for some social services programs that, you know, whether it's Medicaid, you know, food assistance or other things. That is a pretty given or accepted concept that is happening. The reality is it's hard to really determine how much. And if you did a more of a, what would they call a cost accounting kind of basis, supposedly from a business manager perspective, saying how much are we paying out and how much is being contributed on two parts. One, those who have illegal Social Security cards and paying into the system, and those who don't have illegal cards and not paying into the system, but are still buying products at the local grocery store or whatever, maybe paying the sales tax. You know, it's hard to determine that kind of output because those things that you can't really kind of track. So
what
it's easier
to say. What concerns me is the president of Mexico saying that we are racially profiling when we don't want illegal immigration, and you cannot illegally immigrate to Mexico. You would think he'd want his country to be better. But still, it's saying, you know, I don't understand the concept.
Well, it's interesting because I want to touch on that on my legislation portion of some of the policies that we have in the United States that kind of do hurt Mexican farmers and so forth, that kind of eliminated some of their production and wiped them out from the rural areas and send them to the urban areas, which there was less jobs, and therefore if there's no less jobs, they're going to migrate to the United States. You know, this is not just a one-fix-all kind of thing. We got to take a look at everything that we're doing internally here in the United States that's contributing.
You really have a holistic approach to it.
Exactly. Look at it from what I like to call the satellite perspective. You know, you're a satellite in the sky, and you're going to look at the big picture, see how it all plays together, versus just zooming in on one specific situation. Which, you know, people talk about American citizenship and the 14th Amendment, you know. It's easy to focus on the small things, but, you know, you can't resolve issues by just fixing symptoms when you don't really fix the situation or the disease, so to speak.
And like you said, I think that's on both sides of the coin, you know, both sides of the coin. Illegal immigration,
mm-hmm.
felony in Mexico, 2 years in prison, and anyone caught in Mexico after being deported once is sent to prison for 10 years. So we're saying it's on both sides of the coin here.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's where, you know,
democracy on both sides.
And the thing, and that's where the State Department and you know, definitely with Senate Foreign Affairs Committees and stuff like that, it's our job to kind of get involved and try to resolve some of these issues, because that's what our citizens want us to do. You know, a lot of state governors as well as a lot of American citizens are looking at immigration reform and saying, you know, we want to be in the middle. We don't want to go too far to one way direction or too far the other direction. We want to be able to have something that is sound. We want something that addresses all the issues, at the same time supports and defends the Constitution and the laws that we live by. And I mean, that's a given. We have to go by that constitutional rule of law that I'm going to want to get into here a little bit. But just to kind of finish up on my point about border enforcement, is also the two other points I want to focus on is, you know, we got to use the technology that we have to try to enforce some of our security measures, you know, whether it's using the Global Hawk, the unmanned aerial craft, or we're using sensors or whatever it may be, you know, to kind of track this thing. And it's not so much to trying to catch illegal immigrants coming across the border, but you have to look at, they get here because of what we call coyotes. And a coyote is the individual who actually they pay money to, and they pay good money for these individuals to bring them across the border. And they're the ones that are actually breaking the American laws, because they're usually American citizens who are doing it. You know,
you're exactly right there. You're exactly right. I know the coyote situation, and you're exactly right. And I think so many people. I'm glad you touched on that. I think so many people, especially if you're not from Texas or. Well, you could be from any border state, but I don't think they're aware of the coyote.
Oh, no, the coyote is the one.
So if you tell people about it, explain it.
Well, yeah, that's somebody that a national Mexican citizen will pay anywhere from $500 to $5,000 to this individual to cross them to the United States. And that individual is going to hook them up with somebody to get them a job. And then that same coyote will end up working with some individual on the state side who's going to provide the job, and they say, okay, we need so many. Okay, great. I'm going to charge this guy the American business, whatever it may be, agriculture or manufacture, doesn't make a difference, or service. And says, okay, I'll give you five, you know, illegal immigrants, but I'm going to charge you $500 apiece. So then he collects from that individual as well. So by
the
time that
aren't always up above board either. I can remember at one time there were so many of them, the illegal immigrants that they had brought over, they had them in the back of a truck, like a produce truck, mm-hmm. and back in the cabin part, I mean, this huge mm-hmm. truck, and they all died because they were being stopped, and the coyote just got out and took off. Everybody died. They didn't know they were in there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one thing. I think the image that people kind of see is that you have this illegal immigration problem, that you have a mass amount of people crossing this unfenced border, when reality is they're less reluctant to cross an unfenced border and more or less use the systems that they have in place to get them across deeper inside, because they know they're going to be monitoring the border. It's when you kind of get them in containers or whatever it may be to get them further deep in the United States, where you're beyond the checkpoints, and therefore then you can go ahead.
Some of that started when they started deregulating, allowing Mexican truck drivers to drive, and so the American Mexican truck drivers are bringing the coyotes are bringing them over in the trailers,
mm-hmm.
and I think and they're not, and these people are, every dollar they have is going to this.
Exactly, they're just trying to like. And they're trying to make a living, and this is why it's a highly sensitive issue, is because, you know, you have a great amount of Hispanics here in the United States who are pretty much middle of the road on this, which basically means they're more lenient to the conservative side and saying that, you know, we believe in the Constitution, we believe in the United States, we believe that we need to support these laws, but whenever all of a sudden it gets paintbrushed with a big stroke, a wide stroke, ends up saying, oh, but you know what, it's the illegal immigrants that are causing problems. And why it's so sensitive is that you're also talking about the ethnicity of a major race that has roots that go back to Mexico. You can have an Irish-American who has roots that go all the way back to Ireland, but because, you know, it reminds me of that movie Selena. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I was in Houston when poor Selena was assassinated, basically, she was, and came out of the radio and was on TV, and we're saying, what? What? You know, what was the radio? It's like, ka-ka-ka-ka in Houston, and we're saying, what's going on here? So we turned on the TV. We couldn't believe it that this had happened to her.
So basically, what we're saying is that he was saying in the movie, says, you know, Irish Americans and Italian Americans and German Americans and, you know, Japanese Americans, all their roots are across the water. Our roots are right across, you know, the river there.
That's exactly right.
So there's a lot of still, ethnic connection to, you know, to the Mexican people, because those go back to our roots. You know, I'm a fourth generation Texan, okay, but you know what, I still acknowledge my roots that kind of go all the way back to Mexico, as well as the ones that go all the way back to Madrid, Spain, you know, as well as the ones that go with the, you know, the Shoshone Indians. You know, those are things that are important to us, and whenever we get compartmentalized, it's only going to be
minute,
natural.
Wait a minute. You're saying you have Shoshone blood?
It's Shoshone, yes.
Okay, well, you fit in. You got two Cherokees and Shoshone. God, we knew there was a connection here.
So,
okay, but
you know,
seriously, I think you have a holistic approach. You're discussing border security. You're also discussing the cost to the taxpayer. You're discussing the coyote situation. And you're discussing also how sometimes they do pay into the system with someone else's Social Security number. They're not going to collect from that. And they are purchasing goods and services. And while goods and services are going out, you're saying you need to look at the whole problem. You call it the satellite approach, and I think that's a really good term. So you're putting all these factors into consideration and saying, let's build a significant immigration reform and make it work and protect our borders. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, yeah. We don't want them to be using illegal tax numbers, and we don't want them to be – we want them – if they're going to be here in the United States, the bottom line core that everybody agrees with pretty much is saying, we just want them to be legal residents or legally here documented, okay? And that goes back to legislation. You know, reform. That's what immigration reform is. Look at our processes or our policies that are our federal policies that discuss immigration, from the different types of visas to the student visas to the business visas to, you know, the exchange student visas, everything. And look at how is it we're doing it now, and is it functioning or not? And if it's not, then maybe we need to go ahead and fix it. And that's, you know, some of the proposals that I'm looking at. The last point I want to make about border enforcement is that, you know, I've said this, I think, once before. Says I strongly believe that, you know, we need more individuals enforcing that, and that's why I think we could probably hire 20,000 more border agents and put 10,000 on for the border themselves and the other 10,000 in the metropolitan areas to enforce, you know, the federal legislative laws that we have passed. And where you get the funding from that, because it's always going to be the quiz where you get, sound like a Democrat trying to put, you know, create a program, has no funding for it. Well, actually, the funding's already there. All I would end up doing is transfer money from, you know, FEMA/TSA, which is all part of Homeland Security anyway, $1 billion over to, you know, the ICE Enforcement Agency, and you can hire your people because it's already appropriated in Congress.
This is a wonderful, wonderful concept. I'm glad you touched on that. I think it's a wonderful idea. Yes, to hire more, you could transfer money over, and you could still have border enforcement. And, of course, you're creating jobs because the money is already there, and you're taking it out of a fund that is really not doing anything and making it work for you.
Exactly, and that's where, you know, we're looking at it from our cost-activity basis versus a, you know, a cost-accounting basis. They're trying to make, you know, these programs a little more effective. Now, going back to jumping into the federal legislation, for instance, you know, one of the things that I would probably recommend federal legislatures is to really look at is, you know, because the Arizona thing kind of blew up and really kind of got the country in a turmoil, and rightfully so, to be honest with you, the difference between, you know, federal law and state law and who has the right to write federal legislation on immigration or legislation on immigration. And technically you have to go back to the core, and that is the Constitution. And the Constitution right now says that the federal government is the only entity at this point who can write legislative laws. So therefore it's the federal government's responsibility to write laws that can be supported by state legislatures and state law enforcement or local law enforcement, but not mandated.
And the Constitution requires the federal government to defend the borders, right, to defend its national sovereignty, and then write laws. And the problem now is people feel the federal government isn't doing it. Is that correct?
Oh, that's actually what is going on with our immigration system, is the federal system on both sides of the aisle. I mean, if you're pro-immigration or against immigration, it doesn't make a difference. The federal legislation that we have in place is not working for either side right now. It's just a lame duck sitting there with nothing that's happening.
So what you're saying, you're going to take that program. You're not going to take any new monies, but you're going to take that program and take other programs and what's available. And instead of making it a lame duck, making it quack, really, making it work, and then you're going to take these funds that are doing nothing and make them work and turn it into a productive situation that's going to help with immigration reform, which we definitely do need. I think people think it's only along the border, but look at Decatur County, Georgia. You know, they use a lot of illegal immigrants. Wisconsin, my God, in the summertime, you know, they use a lot of them, and they put them out in the corn packing plants and the meat packing plants, and they're not treated well. They're not.
And that's why it's vital when we look at legislative reform that we got to get these individuals documented. If they're going to be here in the United States, they have to be here legally documented, and they have to go through that process because, in a nutshell, those illegal immigrants that are working under the table are not only getting abused by the industries, whether that's, once again, agriculture or manufacture or service industry, you know, because they're not paying them the wages they need to pay, and therefore those wages aren't being reported, and that's a tax base that we, the American people, are not able to collect on. That's why it's important to revise the work visa program that we have in the United States.
You're saying that it would increase the tax base and actually help people if you would have a program where they have to be documented, then they are paying taxes into the system. And
exactly.
I know the illegal immigrants, a lot of them are paid under the table. And these big corn growers are making big mega profits. So that's why they want the cheap labor.
Well, it's funny you say about corn growing, because that's actually one of the things in my legislative approach that I don't think we really realize that the federal government, in all due respect in reference to subsidies, and specifically with the corn industry, you know, when the federal government goes ahead and decides to subsidize the American farmer, and it was intended to help out the small farmer, those that are struggling to subsidize them, but unfortunately we have our farming industry has become a corporate farm now, just like a majority of our businesses. You know, no longer do you have family farms, you have corporate farms owned by, you know, major corporations. You know, they're also getting the subsidies to not produce and keep the cost of corn down. And I'll use that as an example because we're looking at Mexico, which was also grows in an agricultural perspective corn. Because the United States was paying subsidies to American farmers, their price was down, cheaper than the Mexican farmer, and therefore the Mexican farmer was able to produce. They end up 780,000 Mexican farmers had to leave the Mexican agriculture and go into the Mexican cities where there were no jobs. And therefore, those individuals.
This is a very valid point that you've made here. Corn subsidies to corporate farming has destabilized or is contributing to the destabilization of Mexican farmers. Coconut down the wrong way. I know out in Wisconsin, I did a photographic journal one day. I know. That's terrible. I did a photographic journal one day in Wisconsin. Where have all the farmers gone? To make a collection. And there's a large farm out here from Scotland. For God's sakes, it's a corporate farm. All those small farmers are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So they
exactly.
have them from other countries. They're coming. Yes. So therefore, I can remember back when I was working the lecture circuit, and I can remember Kimberly Clark at that time. They were producing toilet paper in Mexico because they were paying them $1 a day plus lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So they've taken advantage many times.
Exactly. And therefore, then you have the influx of, because Mexico's economy is unstable, and especially with NAFTA, the way it came across, you know, all of a sudden basically you end up hurting the American economy as well as the Mexican economy. And the only one to profit were these major corporations and these corporate farms and these major, like I said, corporations who were able to get, you know, a little cheaper labor. Of course, now that's starting to change. But even going back to the corn subsidy issue, you know, in Brazil, they're able to 100% manufacture ethanol out of corn and run their whole entire their entire country under ethanol instead of using gasoline. Only here
you know
in the United States.
Do that here?
Go ahead.
You don't do that here because the alcoholics would buy it and drink it.
I'm sorry? I hate
the
you.
Reason they don't use 100% ethanol for fuel to fuel cars here, like fill it, dispense it from gas stations, is because mm-hmm. alcoholics would drink it.
Shut up.
It's just the truth. That's why they added gas.
I mean, when Dukakis' wife drank some fingernail polish remover, Larry King, and he said, do you think my wife got up and said she wanted to drink nail polish remover? He said she wanted to do something that was fun.
Yeah, and that happens. I mean, actually, when you look at addiction, it's pretty much in itself the core of a lot of things that are going on, in my opinion. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. But at the same time, we're looking at an alternative source of fuel that we could manufacture and not be so much dependent on the Middle East or any other agency, and then at the same time we could pump our own oil. I'm not saying not drill for oil, that we could sell a lot cheaper to the Chinese, and therefore we could have a trade market value kind of thing.
So what you're saying is with your satellite approach, we have border security. We would actually be bringing in from Mexico individuals and women that come to this country and work who are documented, and it would stop some of the terrorist actions that have happened across the border from other countries posing as Mexicans. So you're saying it could eliminate some of those problems, and say for the corn industry, you're saying that aids in destabilizing Mexican farmers. So I like that concept, the satellite approach, looking at all areas of it instead of just saying, wait a minute, you can't come across the border.
Exactly. And the thing is, though, is it's just not, like I said, border security. It's got to do with our federal legislation. You know, we got to simplify, and at the same time, what most Americans want in reference to border security, just not on the border, but we also want to know who's coming into the country, and that's one of the things we want to do. You know, estimated 10 million supposedly illegal immigrants here in the United States. Well, where are they? Wouldn't we like them to be kind of go and get documented and come into the process in the right way?
So what you're saying is, with your program, this satellite program, you're saying you have less government that is more organized, that handles larger situations more effectively.
Exactly. And it's, of course, like I said, ensuring all documented legal immigrants, you know, are paying into the system. Now, the argument is going to be, and continues to be, because this is such a hot issue, is to say, well, how about they're going to come in, they're legal, they're paying into the tax system, so therefore they should be getting, they're going to want Medicaid, they're going to want food assistance, they're going to want all these other things.
Well, and they're getting anyway, Medicaid.
Well, true, but at the same time, well, at what point, and this is where, you know,
because we're going to vote for Obama.
And this is where, as a Hispanic in this situation, I'm going to end up. I don't have a problem putting my foot down. As a matter of fact, my wife and I had this conversation about 15 minutes before the show started, and I was saying, you know what? At one point, do we have to draw the line and say, okay, when do we separate the benefits for those American citizens who are American here and those who are here legally
documented
or illegally? Exactly. So
if they're documented,
they
should be eligible for the same benefits, right?
Well, that's probably where I'm going to probably be a little more on the other side. I do believe that I'm not a candidate of using Medicaid or food assistance program, i.e. food stamps, to provide to non-citizens, American citizens. But I do believe that they should have access to the community health clinics, as well as to nonprofit organizations and religious organizations that provide these services, whether that's a food pantry or. And the good thing about the community.
Plan.
Well, I mean, the community health clinics is pretty much what we grew up in because we didn't have insurance, you know, or I wouldn't say community health clinic. I went straight to the doctor, and it was a pay system. Now, the community health clinics work on a sliding scale fee, okay, which basically means how much do you make, and this is how much you need to pay to go see the doctor. You know, versus, oh, we're going to go ahead and maximize the Medicaid program, and then you're going to end up getting all these services, and the doctor's going to order these services, and all these pharmaceuticals and stuff like that, they're going to be ordered, that really run up the cost of Medicaid. You know, let's use our community health clinics that are out there. You know, let's use the organizations out there that provide food assistance. You know, one of the organizations I was kind of looking at, and I don't know if you, the St. Vincent de Paul Association with the Catholics, who's focusing on the needy and individuals. You know, those are the organizations that you kind of assist individuals. You know,
I love your ideas, because I was in healthcare management for years, and it's not just illegal immigrants. But let me tell you, people do work the Medicaid system, and they're encouraged to. You sell all your property, get rid of all your money, put it somewhere else, and then you can go on Medicaid. And it happens.
Oh,
well, these are legal American citizens.
Don't forget, you got to have babies.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually going to address that, believe it or not.
But look, when it all really comes down to it, you know, it's not about the borders, it's not about nationalities, it's not about the government. It's like nobody wants to see somebody else go hungry or be sick. So of course we want to take care of our neighbors, whoever comes here. You know, if they're hungry or homeless or or whatever, you know, we're going to feed them, we're going to take care of them, we're going to give them some place to live. And, you know, I mean, we could debate borders, you know, all day long. I mean, it is an important issue because, well, just because of everything you're discussing, I'm not going to recap it, you know. But, yeah, when it comes right down to it, what are you going to, you're going to turn people away? I mean, we got this big green lady dressed up and, you know, holding a lantern, you know, in the what is that, the Hudson River, you know, up there in New York, you know, give us your tired, your weak, your poor, and, you know, all that stuff.
That's true, but it reaches a point to where maybe the services aren't there anymore. It reaches a point to where, yes, we want to take care of you. We don't have the medicine. It doesn't exist. We don't have the pills in the cabinet. We don't have the vaccines and the shots. We don't have the doctors available. As Cass says, there has to be a system put in place to organize that, because right now it's out of control. Sure, we'll give it to you, but it's out of control. And I like that satellite approach. You document them. They pay into the system. They're eligible for certain benefits.
Right.
Certain benefits they're not.
I mean, well, you know, help somebody out, but not, you know, not let them make a way of life out of it, you know? You know, so, I mean, you know, you're looking from one extreme to the other. We're not going to turn people away. You know we're not going to do that, no matter how much we argue and debate it. We're not going to turn people away, you know? And, what we're really looking at is, okay, if we don't take care of ourselves, if we don't have food in our pantry, how can we feed somebody else? I think that's kind of what
we're
talking
about. Well, people are turned
away
from major hospitals in large cities, and I've seen that happen. I've seen people not allowed into the buildings because they don't have insurance or have some kind of program. So we do turn people away. We don't realize it. Romantically, we don't, but realistically, we do.
I don't know if it's different in different states, but around here, if you go to the emergency room, they have to take you, basically. I mean, they can't say, oh, well, you don't have insurance, or you're not from this country. You know, they treat you, and
well,
then they worry about sending
you
the bill.
Well, let me tell you, I've seen in Houston, they say, I'm sorry, we can't take care of you. We don't have the resources.
Well, and they're required only to stabilize you, not really provide any further stabilization unless it's the county hospital. And then, of course, then they could probably do more than that. But, Mike, you make a real good point about, you know, about the pantry situation. And unfortunately, that's how this whole argument is kind of going through. That if I ain't got enough for me, why am I going to share with somebody else? And what I'm wanting to focus on.
Or how can you?
Well, here's what I would like to see us happen is, though, is we really, really need to look at the legislative policies that are in place that are preventing this situation from playing out in the way it should play out. And what I mean by that is that the reason I don't have any food in my pantry is because the government itself and the bureaucracies and their policies have just splurged expensively to the point that now the value of the dollar is not anything. So that's why I don't have any food in my pantry, because you spent too much stuff on money, Uncle Sam. And what we're trying to do is say, okay, well, hold on. We want to put food back in your pantry, but we're going to have to start cutting some programs and some services to the programs. And if you had to ask me, do I want to cut Medicaid for an American citizen? Or do I want to cut Medicaid for somebody who's not an American citizen? I'm more than likely going to cut it for the person who's not an American citizen. But at the same time, I do want to be compassionate about providing them the health and that they need. And therefore, there is another system in place, and that is a community health care system.
And yeah, you're exactly right. Because it reaches a point sometime, no matter what you want to do, you just don't have the money to do it.
And I think that's where the from a fiscal conservative perspective, saying we want to get back to the point where we can manage this a little better. And then, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, guess what? Anything about process improvement and total quality measure is about re-look at your processes. Just don't just keep it the same. And if we need to do something different 10 years or 15 or 20 years down the road with immigration, so be it. You do that instead of just – and look at your demographics from that perspective. You know, here's the biggest concern and why – from an immigration perspective is that, and I talked about this kind of last week, was the birth rate in the United States is significantly going down. I think I even read somewhere where it was even published. And you need so many tax-paying citizens in order to sustain the programs that you have. So
right,
we're
creating a dependent society, and we cannot exist.
And you need a certain cash flow coming back in revenue and taxes, and not under the table like they're working, is not going to help our tax-based system. And those individuals, even those who may say, okay, we want you out of here. Well, you can go ahead and kick them out, but guess what happens when you're ready to retire and say, oh, I'm sorry, there's no money in Social Security to pay you because we don't have anybody paying into it, you know? So
exactly
right.
Yeah, that's
I like the satellite plan saying with documentation, you could bring in additional revenue that would be able to provide services and be able to keep the country going, and you would limit services, which we have to do because we can't be a totally dependent society. And you're saying part of this plan of the documentation, part of that would serve to focus in that area. Is that correct?
Yes, because when we look at, like, the, for instance, the visas, you got an H-1 visa, you got an H-2 visa, you got a NAFTA visa, you got a business visa, you got a work visa. I mean, there's so many different type of visas with different policy and regulation. Now you can just streamline it. Here you're going to call it either a work visa or it's a tourist visa or it's an education visa, period, you know. Instead of trying to create all these different stipulations, or there's also the fiancé visa, by the way, as well, you know, in reference to that. Yeah, there is. A fiancé or fiancé, which basically means if you want to, you know, bring your married spouse who's, you know, a Russian or Taiwanese or whatever, you know, then, you know, you get them a visa. And then, of course, if they have kids, then you bring the kids over, too, as well, and so forth. You know, the whole immigration process or policy program, in my opinion, is just broke. And I think it's now starting to come to a head, especially with the recession going on. And there's no job creation going on because...
Recession.
So you're really saying that the whole process is outdated. It needs to be revamped. It's broken. It needs to be fixed. And it needs to be fixed in terms of constitutional authority. Is that correct?
Exactly, and you got to focus back on the Constitution, you know. And this is probably where, you know, when it comes to, and I'm going to use this word, I'll just say individuals who are born here in the United States and they're individuals, you know, that's a real hot topic right now here in the United States. Saying, well, just because you're born here does not mean you're an American citizen. You should be going back to the place of your origin. Well,
that was originally intended to for the children of slaves. If a slave was brought to this country and had a child here, that child had a choice of being an American citizen because they were brought here as a slave, so the child had the right to be considered a citizen. It was not really meant for what we're using it now. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard to say what it was meant for, to be honest with you, because we were the one that wrote it.
I think that was the original intent when they read it for the children of slaves.
All I know is that as I read it, you know, it says if you're born in the boundaries of the United States or American soil, you're an American citizen. Is that pretty fair?
Yeah.
And my only argument is I have no problem with that. But at the same time, though, just because you're an American citizen, you don't have at least at this point, the capacity to exercise your American rights. So therefore, you will retain your citizenship as an American, but does not automatically mean that you have to go ahead and stay in the United States.
I see what you're saying.
You know, once you become of legal age 18, you can do what you're an American. You can exercise your citizenship. Or if you get emancipated, adjudicated by emancipation by a federal, you know, administrative law judge, says, okay, yeah, you're good enough, 16. Yeah, you can go ahead and exercise your rights. I mean, it's no more than our children nowadays.
That's a very interesting point. And this is the first time I have heard anyone speak on this subject of those being born an American citizen, have been born in this country, and provide a plan, a step-by-step outline for how you exercise those rights. So I hope everybody is paying attention to what you're saying, because I think this is important.
Well, and it helps in the process if your parents, let's just say they're documented residents here in the United States, and you're born in the United States, but you're an American citizen, and you can stay here. Guess why? Because your parents already documented here to work here, or they're applying for the citizenship, or, you know, their education, they're applying for their education, they're going to continue an education, you know. Therefore, you get to stay in the United States until, you know, their visa expires or they renew, whatever. But if you happen to be 18 and now suddenly their visa expires, guess what? You can stay because you're an American citizen.
See, that's a really good point that you've made. I haven't heard anybody else. I've heard them discuss it, but I haven't heard them outline the plan that you're outlining, which gives a step-by-step instruction. It allows the people to know where you stand. Okay, this is what your rights are. This is what your rights aren't. And I like this. You've opened it up, a new area that can go into immigration reform. It gives another dimension to it. Now, one of my best friends, she was from Chile, and her parents came to Manhattan when she was, I think, 7 years old. And they became citizens, and when they became citizens, she also became a citizen. I don't know what the rules were at that time because she's my age. I got to tell you my story. She was in the movies, okay? She did lots of movies. And she married a racer, and she gave up her career, and he was very successful and had a big business for it and everything. So one day, when I was traveling abroad to get my, to go to school, to go to Paris and try to get her birth certificate, she couldn't get it. Well, finally, she got three of them. Well, then, because she was actually born in Santiago. Well, so then, anyway, one day, she wanted me to do her chart for it. I said, okay, you're born on this year. She said, no, I'm not. I said, yes, you are. She said, no, I'm not. I said, you're 4 years younger than I am. You're born on this year. She's, oh, hell, I always lied about my age just because of the movies. I'm actually older than you are. Anyway, that's my story.
And let me go ahead and just kind of wrap up the legislation portion real quick because I know we're probably getting short on time. But one of the other things I want to stress because it has to do with from the education perspective, if an individual is going to go to post-secondary education, i.e. university or college or something in the United States, they should only fall into two categories. American citizen or not an American citizen, whether you're documented here, you're legally documented here on an education visa. If you're an American citizen, you pay the tuition rates according to whatever that university says. If you're not,
so therefore you're really eliminating a large problem for out of state tuition. This really is an extensive reform package.
Well, I mean, because it focuses on the fact that, and actually, the universities are the ones that are losing money by not being able to charge, individuals who are not here on an education visa, the ability to pay foreign, international foreign tuition,
Well, let me tell you, I had to pay when I went to school in Paris. I had to pay big time.
Exactly, and because you were not a resident of Paris. Even though you were there legally, you still had to pay the international rate. And I think the same thing should apply to our post-secondary education systems, if you're here in the United States, then you're paying the American rate. And I only say it because it's not fair to those American citizens who want to go to the same university but are from another state, and they're having to pay out-of-state tuition while the person there who is not a resident of that state, who is not a resident of the United States, is paying in-state tuition rates.
Excellent package you have outlined here, and I like the idea that you've differentiated between a work visa an education visa, because I know when I was there, I was on an education visa. However, I could have certain jobs. And one of my jobs, I taught English to engineers, the Alliance Française, that were doing business with the States. And I had a large group that sought me out specifically, not because I was this little cutie pie, but because I was from Texas. And they were doing business in Texas, and they already spoke English, they wanted Texas English. They wanted Texas American English to be able to fit in. So the point of the story is there was a limit on what I could do when I was in school. I could have something like that, but I couldn't just go out and take a job away from a French citizen.
Exactly. And the last portion has to do with citizenship, and that focus on it goes back to what originally started. Society enforces the laws, not Congress, and that means that it's society, it's our communities who have to take these legal residents or these citizens and assimilate them into our national culture, our national identity, which is, once again, going back to the Constitution of the United States, a lot of our moral values and respective to that, versus shutting them out and so forth. So it's the communities that have to look at these individuals and say, all right, you're in the United States here legally, and therefore here's what it's about to be an American citizen. It's no more.
So are you saying that this goes into states' rights, and this could be how the state comes in and defines something? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not so much the state rights as just your local community. I mean, if my neighbor across the street was here legally, and is documented, I'm gonna let him know what it is to be like an American. I'm gonna set the example.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Assimilate
you need that community interaction.
Society. Exactly.
Absolutely.
And that's where the citizens come into play, because if somebody's not here illegally, as much as I want to help them, I also take a look at that. But, I'm hurting the person over here that's trying to do it the right way, yet you're over here hurting their chances and hurting everybody else. So
what you're saying is each one of us has to take responsibility for how this country is going to be run. Each one of us has to take an active part in the safety and welfare of our country and everybody in it, instead of just waiting for some government agency to do it. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. It's called We the People of the United States in order to
Absolutely.
Form a perfect union.
You know, Kath, just can you go over and just recap basic points in your satellite plan?
Well, it's just basically hitting the border enforcement issue, you know, trying to utilize all our resources that we have available, empowering people, you know, like, and this is one of the things I talk about legislation was empowering, you know, whether the sheriff's department or the state police or somebody wants to do that, to give them the option, not mandate them that they have to do it, but give them the option along with the training that they have to have in order to be able to do that. So using that perspective, using all our resources, transferring funds from, you know, FEMA and TSA to support and hire more border agents. You know, then looking at it from the legislative perspective is that, you know, we need to revamp. We need to process and improve our immigration laws and our immigration policies and procedures of how we do those and make them more demographic to the United States, because the Hispanic population is a very growing population. And it's going to change the way our political culture is. And then the last one ends up focus on, but yet it still comes down to we the people assimilating everybody else, just like we did for 200 plus years of getting people to become Americans first and still maintain their ethnicity.
And Cass, how can people help you? You don't have to be from Texas, but we can have your name from Maine to California, from New Mexico to Florida, and from Wisconsin to Texas. How can people help you, even if they don't contribute? How can they help you by just making sure you're on the ballot and everybody knows you're running? What can they do?
They can make phone calls for me. They can get involved with it. They can email their get the email process network set up that we're established. They can make financial contributions, and you know Mike's done a great job of posting the information on his website, and I encourage people to get on his website to hear all the topics that he discussed. But in there, it's got my website information and stuff like that he lists, because sometimes you can't always catch it over the phone. But it's CASforSenate.com, CAS, because sometimes people put two S's. And that way we kind of get involved in making this an American revolution.
And Mike also put podcasts up. You can go on Twitter and you can download a podcast. You can download it for Facebook and YouTube.
Yep. And I'm going to put a YouTube video together here within the next week or two for my website as well. So.
And like I said, Mike always has podcasts up, so they can find him on Facebook, they can find him on his site, they can find him on Twitter, and they can find him on YouTube, because mm-hmm. he always puts those up so they can find them anywhere they want to go. And Mike, what's the name of your site so people can look at that?
I'm so glad you mentioned this, Dolly, because my site has been down for the past day while I was redoing some code and stuff
so
like that.
So we're just going to focus on Cass's site, what we're going to focus on then?
No. Let me finish real quick. I was going to announce it at the beginning of the show. I completely revamped communicationcreations.com so that it's just for a radio station. I've moved all the other junk to some other other sites. I've broken them up. So now Communication Creations is just our shows with Cass and Reverend James Wright and Larry Ballard, and it's actually a podcast format.
So they can go to communications.com?
Communicationcreations.com. And, yeah, I was coming out to the beginning of the show that it's all new, and, I was a little tardy. But while you guys were talking, I was still working on it, and it's back up now. So, yeah, it's communicationcreations.com. And, Dolly, I hate to do this to you and Cass, but you guys got to sign up again because it's all new. So,
okay. We can do that. And, Cass, you let me know what I can do on email campaign or on phone campaigns, and you just email me and tell me what to do.
Yep, and I will do.
And we can do it. And then people, again, communicationscreations.com, you can get all of Cass's material. And then CassForSenate.com, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
CassForSenate.com, you can go to both of those places. And on your website, you've got a lot of your policies and everything, and tell people how they can help and what they can do so
mm-hmm.
that we can get you elected to the Senate in 2012.
Yes, ma'am. That's the plan.
That's the plan.
That's the plan. 2012.
We're behind you.
All righty.
And I got to run. You know, my desktop is calling me. Unfortunately, I can hear it saying, Dolly, Dolly, get your butt in here. So I have to go talk to it.
Y'all well, I appreciate it, Dolly.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Man. Thank you, Dolly.
Thank you.
And thank you, Cass. That was a very good topic tonight. That was a very good topic, very informative and educational, and yeah, something to think about. See, you're bringing up all these issues that people don't think about when they vote. They just go, oh yeah, that's the guy. Well, yeah, I liked his commercial. Let's go vote for him. You're bringing up real issues here, sir, and that's great.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. I really do. That's what I want to do. I mean, you know. Anyway, if I have to follow my sword on what I believe in, so be it. But if you don't believe in something and stand up for what you believe in, then you're just a politician.
Yeah, that's exactly it, man. And see, that's the thing. I mean, if people don't know what you man, it's kind of hard to explain. But, you know, Obama, you know, just use him as an example. Obama, I don't think people really knew the issues that they were voting for when they voted for him. You know, they just, you know, hey, he's a good-looking guy. Listen to him talk, you know. And I don't think many people knew the issues, you know. And, you know, they were like, oh, it'll be the first black president, you know. To vote for somebody, you know. So, yeah, like with you bringing out issues about immigration and all the other stuff we talked about, you just go down the list, and you know, the things that people don't really think about when they go to vote, and you know, the issues that they see every day, but they don't really think about who they're voting for is going to affect that, especially a senator, you know, because yeah, a senator, they think, oh, well, that guy's running in Texas, you know, I live across the country, I live, you know, in another state, you know, it has nothing to do with me, but it does, you know, because
mm-hmm.
senators make laws, you know,
yeah.
federal laws, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's another thing I think is, people know it, you know, but it's not at the top of their head, like what you brought up last week about, I think you were talking to a kid about who makes the laws, and he said the president.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not the president. It's,
yeah.
You know, it's Congress, the Senate. You know, that's who makes the laws. The president can say no, but, you know, it's pretty much
mm-hmm.
goes to the House, you know. So.
But it's society who enforces them, remember. We the people.
Society. That's what it all comes down to. This is a government
mm-hmm.
by the people, for the people. It is a republic, not a democracy. We do vote, so that makes it, that kind of makes it a democracy, but that's not how our government is set up. So,
yeah.
What do you think about what's going on in over there in Egypt right now? Isn't that crazy? They really can't stand that guy.
Well,
have you seen that?
Yeah, and it's once again, I have to go back to, you know, I don't like to really kind of point fingers and say this, but I do want to look at programs and processes, and that's, in my opinion, a failed failed foreign policy programs and policies. You know, I think we were just trying to go with the same status quo and keep the things the way they were, and didn't realize that the demographics and didn't realize that the politics in the region were changing, and didn't adjust to it, and now we're starting to see it to kind of come up and bite our butt, and you know, trying to stick, you know, whatever the president's position or how he's trying to position himself, you know, is trying to play catch up now behind the eight ball. You know, I think we really let that region, as well as many other regions, you know, in the world, fall apart because we did not lead in foreign policy the way we probably should have.
So you think our foreign policy is partly to blame for what's going on in Egypt right now?
Oh yeah. I mean, because when you think about it, our policy was to support Mubarak and then pumping with the billions of dollars of aid each year and to support, you know, all these things and trying to stabilize the region. It's no more than, you know, what we were doing in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. I mean, he was our buddy there for a while, and we were giving him billions of dollars, you know, to fight the Iranians or to hold off or stage off the Iranians. But we started putting all our eggs in one basket, and we started kind of thinking that this is the way it's going to be, and didn't realize that the demographics and the politics of that situation in that region were shifting. And I would venture to say that a lot of it probably ends up having to do with the cutbacks in the Central Intelligence Agency, the outlets and the organizations and the offices that we had in throughout the world has significantly diminished, and we weren't getting the intel that we needed to kind of dictate or to provide information to our legislators. Say, oh, look, we're probably going to have to change, you know, tactics here. We're going to probably have to change strategies. We'll probably have to change supports. We've got to keep an eye on what's going on over here. I mean, those are all part of the foreign policy perspective. But if you continue to function, you know, status quo, says, okay, I'm just going to go ahead and go on the way that the previous administration did, you know, you're going to get burned. Because things change.
Well, that guy, he was Houston president for 30 years. And this is what, okay, all right, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, I'm being your typical dumbass. On this subject, I am the guy who only saw this on CNN and got my news from here and there. Don't really know the inside of it, okay? But this guy's been in office for 30 years. And just now, you know, like 3 days ago, whatever it's been, all of a sudden it's a riot. I mean, you know, what about the first 5 or 10 years? What about the first 20 years? Nobody said anything. And now 30 years later, everybody, you know, it's anarchy over there, or it's about to be. And my understanding of it was that it was mostly because people were, you know, they couldn't they didn't have any jobs, and the jobs they did have didn't pay. And basically it was an economical thing that they were trying to get this, you know, tell this guy, you know, you're not going to be president anymore. And he said, no, I'm going to be president until September. After that, I won't run again. Then Mr. Obama, you know, he made his little speech, and you know how that goes. He said a whole lot of stuff that sounded good, but he really didn't say anything. So everything you just said, news to me, sir. I really didn't know about any of that.
I mean, it's kind of like it's been somewhat of our foreign policy to, you know, to use, you know, we use the word paper regime kind of individuals to put them in place to kind of keep our perspective, our national interest in place. But the thing is, though, is that eventually those individuals cannot individually hold on power too long, and things are going to shift. Whether it's economics is shifting, whether it's the politics is shifting, whether it's the demographics, and demographics basically not mean just so much in reference to race or ethnicity, but we're also looking demographics and change to, you know, religious, you know, beliefs and infiltration. I mean, when you think about it, Iran, though, is going to be infiltrating a lot of the policy, or dictating, in my opinion, a lot of the policy that's happening in the Middle East. And they're going to do it pretty much the way we've done it for the past, you know, 50 years. You're going to get in ground, you're going to start infiltrating situations, you're going to get organizations, and you're going to want to create chaos and instability, okay? And then you're going to have to point the blame somewhere, and eventually it's going to go to, you know, the Western United States or the West, or it's going to end up going to Israel or to both, you know? Eventually, you know, there's got to be some bad guy, and like right now, the United States, who is our enemy? Well, right now, the Taliban or Al Qaeda? You know, where are they? You know, so we're focused on that. We're not really looking at all the other things that are going on.
We trained the Taliban, Al Qaeda. You know, they became Al Qaeda. We trained them. You know,
and we grew them at the same time too. So.
Yeah, like here's how to kick our asses. You know. But, you know, well, they were supposed to kick somebody else's asses, but then later on they turned and used their what we taught them against us. And they didn't get very far, but they did some damage, you know.
Well, and I mean, but they're still, you know, going on in Pakistan, and they're still going on in Afghanistan. You know, you can't
see, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I didn't realize that Egypt had anything to do with what's going on in the Middle East. I guess geographically they're close. But, I mean, it's actually another continent, but it's like, I guess it's like kind of close.
Yeah, I mean, we got to go through that canal in order to go around through to the Persian Gulf, the Suez Canal, which is, you know, on the border right there. So you know, you think about even from a strategic perspective of how that it plays into our national interest. You know, there's just a lot of things that, you know, we kind of just sat back and didn't, we started, in my opinion, the administration started focusing a lot of their foreign policy on other countries instead of focusing on probably where we needed to be. And we let up a lot of our allies down, and that's starting to come and uproot itself.
I mean, I really didn't realize we had that much to do with Egypt. And I'm sorry, all you Egyptians. I didn't know. I mean, I just didn't realize because, you know, you guys are all quiet in the news. You don't hear about stuff going on in Egypt every day. You know, this is like all of a sudden, you know, there's a riot in Egypt, really? So, yeah, when you talk about the UN and stuff, you see the president of Egypt, or not the president, but the ambassador, is that what you call him?
Yeah, you see the guy sitting there,
but he never really says anything, you know. And I didn't realize there were problems there, you know. So that's really, you know, it just seemed like it came out of the blue, but I guess it didn't.
Well, no, because I think I was reading an article, and then this is one good thing about the media the way it is now, is that you can get your news not from the main sources. You have to really kind of dig and find out where they're at. But there was one individual, and there's a British source, actually, who said, you know, he saw that everything was going down and how everything was playing out, especially in Iran. And somebody asked him, and this was about 2 years ago, so where do you think the next hot place is going to be? And he said, it's going to be Egypt. And guess what? We're talking about Egypt.
Wow. You see, that's what I usually do. I usually don't just believe what I see on CNN. I go on the Internet and research it and talk to people and when I say go on the Internet, I don't just like read blogs that people wrote. Yeah, although that is a good way. But I mean, there's sites where, you know, there's people from all over the world on there, and you know, you can go on there and actually see what you can see. Well, actually, they cut the Internet off over there in Cairo, or I think all of Egypt for a while. I don't know if it's back up, but they cut off cell phone communications and Internet. But usually, when something is going on in a part of the world, you can go on different sites, different forums and stuff like that, and actually see what the people, like, you know, if you heard there was something going on in Virginia Beach, you could probably bet that if I have the, you know, if I'm able to, I'm going to be on the Internet talking about it. And, you know, it's just like that all over the world. You can go on these sites, and, like, iPower is one of them, iPowerProject.com. And, you know, it's not where I get my news. It's not a news site. But you can actually go on there, and there's people talking about what's going on in their – that's their community, you know. And I'm pretty sure I can go on the site right now and find somebody from Egypt, and they're talking about what's going on if they're able to get on the Internet.
Well, when you look at any organizational structure, and I'm going to just kind of look at organization, even from a business organization or whatever it may be, when you look at it from this perspective, there's two levels of, or two venues of communication. You have your formal communication, which is basically everything that kind of flows through the normal channels, goes up and down, lateral, whatever it may be. But then there's that other one that you probably heard about and accustomed to, and that we call it the grapevine. And that's the one that's kind of underneath that doesn't go through the usual channels. It's in the roots and stuff like that. And that's, you know, something that any manager, executive would end up having to listen to, just like our the administration should be listening to the grapevine channels, not just what's getting pumped up through the formal channels. You know, and I think that's where we kind of lost our tentacles, you know, once again, with the CIA and other agencies, that we never long put our vines in there and left them in there. Instead, we pulled them out, and now we don't really have a good feel of what's going on underneath the smoke and mirrors.
Right. That's what, like I said, that's what I usually do. So I brought it up, and like I kind of, you know, called my fans down on this one because I really didn't realize all that background. Because, you know, I'm glad I asked though, because I'm wondering, like I said, I'm wondering why, you know, this guy's been in there 30 years. I mean, Obama's been in there 2 years, you know. It didn't take us long to start bitching. And so I'm trying to figure out what's going on. But, yeah, that's usually what it is. There's a bunch of underlying reasons, and it doesn't make world news until somebody throws a Mai Tai cocktail at a tank. So, yeah, that does make sense.
All righty, Mike. Well, I'm going to let you be. I really appreciate it. Good conversation, by the way.
Yes.
I can't wait to meet you in person one day.
Well, one day, sir, one day. Yeah, definitely. I don't get out into the Midwest much, but if I ever do, I'll definitely make an effort to. Well, you know what? When you're senator, and I do say when because I'm an optimist, when you're senator, you're going to be coming to D.C. a lot, and that is right down the street from me.
Exactly, exactly. And going back to the grapevine, I'll consider you one of my grapevine assets.
There you go. I'm that Internet guy. You know, you don't even know his real name. He just goes by MJH. Yeah, everybody knows my real name. No, I can't. MJH is just a facade. What if I got a this is Michael Hammer, and, you know, people would be like, who? Now, I've tried that. I've tried that on a couple of shows with Larry Ballard. They're like, why don't you use your real name? And, you know, Hammer, you know, Dolly's like, Hammer is such a powerful name. I was like, no, it's not. But, you know, if you want me to use my real name, you know, I'll use my real name. I'll try it. And everybody's like, Mike Hammer. People on Facebook have got my name up there, you know. Who? So Michael Hammer's doing the show tonight. Who's that? Look at my picture. It's me.
Just call him the Hammer. You're the Hammer.
Yeah. Well, if I say MJ Ace, they go, oh, that dickhead. But we'll listen because it's usually entertaining. Because I have great guests and a great co-host. And, you know, it's a team effort. It really is. But thank you very much, Cass.
All right, Mike. Well, I will see you next week.
I'll see you then. I'm sure you'll have another great topic for us next week. And have you checked out American Idol this season, by the way?
No, actually I haven't. I've
been
too doggone busy. No, I get too busy to watch.
If you have a chance, it's on right now. Well, actually, I think it comes on an hour later where you're at. No, it's the same time where you're at. You're in Central Time. But Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez, they're doing a really good show.
Right.
I thought I'd miss Simon because, you know, he was kind of like he was always critical, but he was really, like, so entertaining. I don't really miss him. You know, the new judges are doing a great job. And Steven Tyler, you know, and Jennifer Lopez, they're just really awesome. So if you have a chance, check it out. You know,
you see, there you go. There's a good case of process improvement.
Yeah, I do still kind of miss Simon, but, you know, this has been a great season so far of American Idol. I'm going to go check that out, and I'm going to post this podcast on communicationcreations.com now that I've got it back up, and it'll also be available on Blog Talk Radio and castforsummit.com. So we'll see you all next Wednesday.
All right, take care, Mike.
All right, later on. Andrew Castanilla.
Okay.
2012, everybody. All right. This is MJ. Peace, God bless, and we're out of here. Later.